The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. I'm Vic McCunis. I'm very excited about my guest and his book this morning. As many of you know, I'm a huge fan of libraries and librarians. And today our book is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. It's a fascinating story, retold by Joshua Hammer, and he will join us in the Book Nook this morning. But first, the news from National Public Radio. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Joshua Hammer. He's just published a very inspiring book, and I've been eager to say the title on the radio because you don't get titles this good very often on book programs. It's The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. Welcome to the program, Josh.
Thank you, Vic.
Wow, Josh, what a story. Tell us how you came upon this story.
Sure. I'll go back to 1995 when I was Newsweek's Africa Bureau Chief, and I made my first trip to Timbuktu and just kind of was mesmerized by the place, by the remoteness and the history. And when I was a freelance writer 10 years later, after having left Newsweek, looking for story ideas, a small article caught my eye about these 500-600-year-old manuscripts, Islamic and secular manuscripts from the glory days of Timbuktu that had been basically lost over the centuries, dispersed into the desert. And over the last few years, beginning in the late 1990s, had been recollected and restored, and libraries had been created, and there was kind of a boom going on related to the manuscripts in Timbuktu. So I pitched the story to Smithsonian Magazine, where I had an editor friend, and within a week I was on my way to Timbuktu, and that's how my connection to this story and to the hero of the book began.
Some of our listeners will recall when this happened in Timbuktu, when there was an attack and an invasion by Islamists from the north in Mali. Some of our listeners are probably not familiar with Timbuktu. They don't know where it is. They don't know anything about it. Let's tell them what it is. What is so special?
Timbuktu is, it's become kind of a metaphor for remoteness. People probably know the name without knowing anything else about it. It's a fabled city in northwest Africa, basically situated at the highest point of the Niger River, which is the third longest river in Africa. So where that river meets the Sahara Desert, there was a city called Timbuktu created about 1,000 years ago that grew into an incredibly wealthy trading center by the 14th century, and for a couple of hundred years it flourished both as a trading center and as a center of scholasticism, a university town, and then there were a succession of unfortunate events, including being conquered by Morocco, a case of the plague, and basically Timbuktu was lost in time, really, became forgotten. And then in the 19th, but this legend surrounded it because of its glory days and rumors that the city was still paved with gold and So beginning in the early 19th century, European explorers began racing toward Timbuktu. I think there was a prize offered by a couple of geographical societies for the first Westerner to reach Timbuktu. And those who did arrive, several of them were killed by Islamic chieftains, warlords, who didn't appreciate non-Muslims entering the city. And those who did arrive were incredibly disappointed, because by then the city had become kind of a dilapidated, desolate town in the middle of the desert. But even so, the legend surrounding Timbuktu remained very strong and continues to this day.
Joshua Hammer joins us. His book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts, has just been published. And I guess it was fortunate from the standpoint of preservation that Timbuktu is in a climate that's becoming increasingly drier, and desertification is happening there, because this helped preserve a lot of these ancient manuscripts. Let's talk about the central figure in your story. You really wouldn't have a story without this guy, would you?
No, I don't think so. Well, you'd have a story, but it wouldn't be nearly as good. You always want to have a great central character to build a tale around. And he fit the bill perfectly. He was the son of a scholar from Timbuktu, who grew up surrounded by his family's personal collection of manuscripts. When he was 17, he discovered that his father, upon his death, had left him had named him the custodian of these manuscripts. So he had this tremendous sense of responsibility surrounding him, and he was somewhat reluctant about it. A couple of years later, a recently established government library, the curator of this library, wanted to send somebody out to aggressively search and collect manuscripts that had been, as I said, dispersed in the desert, and Abdul Qadir fit the bill. The curator asked Abdul Qadir if he would do the job. Abdul Qadir didn't want to. He says he told me he wanted to get rich. He wanted to make money. He wanted to be a businessman. Hmm. The curator kept pressing him to do this job. Finally, he relented in 1984. And then for the next 12 years, he embarked on this rather astonishing quest by camel, riverboat up and down the Niger River, stopping in villages in the desert and on the riverbanks, tracking down lost manuscripts that dated as far back as the 12th century. And he proved to be incredibly proficient at this. He could recognize great works. He had a great nose for ferreting them out. He was a skilled negotiator. He knew which books were more valuable than others, and he was also he developed great skills as a restorer of manuscripts. So he turned this backwater library, the Ahmed Baba Center in Timbuktu, from a place that had maybe a couple of thousand manuscripts amassed over a couple of decades, to a thriving institution with about 100,000 manuscripts. And over time, he not only did he resuscitate the Ahmed Baba Institute, or revitalize the Ahmed Baba Institute, but he then developed his own library. He proved to be an expert at raising money. He reached out and established connections across the Middle East, Europe, and even the United States, raising funds, built his own library, got other collectors to build their own, arrange for them to get funding. And by 2003, 2004, had really changed Timbuktu from this desolate, lost, very poor city into something of a cultural hub, an unlikely cultural hub. Not quite the way it was back in its glory days, but far improved economically, culturally, from what it was before he began this quest.
And when he took over as the book hunter and began these expeditions to locate these rare manuscripts all over the region, the people who had been his predecessors had essentially failed because they didn't have the right approach, and they weren't getting that many manuscripts. And he went out there, and this is really my favorite part of the book, because what a treasure hunt. When he's out there sniffing around, so many of these people won't admit they even have any rare manuscripts.
True.
It's really brilliant. I love that part of the story. The one where he finds this would you pronounce it a Tuareg?
Tuareg, yeah.
He finds this gentleman who can't even afford to give him a cup of tea. And I don't want to do a spoiler on this, but
one of the sections I always read.
Oh, yeah, I love that part.
I like it too.
What a wonderful story that is. And man, did he hit the gold mine there.
He hit a lot of jackpots, yeah. He had a whole different approach, as you said. He was modest, as his predecessors would bomb into these villages in a convoy of Land Rovers and freak people out, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Abdul Qadir would basically trudge for days in either camel caravan or on his own and show up in a humbly dressed and just kind of slowly insinuate himself into the community, gain people's trust. It should be pointed out that people were frightened because they had this vestigial fear from the days when the French colonialists conquered Timbuktu. They occupied the city and the country for about 80 years, and they began searching themselves for these manuscripts, and in fact stole many, took them to museums and libraries in Paris and other cities in France.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people had a great suspicion and fear of anybody who came in to looking for manuscripts. And also, of course, these were valuable. They viewed them as family heirlooms, as treasure. And so it was, they would hear rumors that people were coming to look for their manuscripts, and they would immediately, they would bury them or not even admit that they had them. That was generally the game that they played until Abdul Qadir came along and developed all these stratagems for reassuring them and bringing them out of the shadows.
And he was humbly dressed so that he wasn't intimidating. And he also was carrying an awful lot of cash. And it was very helpful to be humbly dressed because that way he didn't get robbed. And he had all this cash because he was willing to pay top dollar if he found the right book. He would pay whatever he needed to pay because, man, did he have an eye for spotting the real jewels.
He paid a lot of money, but as he found pretty quickly, offering cash to people was often viewed as an insult.
Oh.
They didn't like to equate their family treasure with cold, hard cash. So he developed other methods. He began to barter.
Uh-huh.
He found out that people had a great longing for printed books, which, of course, were a lot more common and easier to obtain. But in the minds of these villagers who'd been who are somewhat isolated, the idea of printed books was something really to be valued. So he would arrange with bookstores around the Maghreb area in northern Africa. He would get shipments of printed books, and he would trade them for manuscripts. And people were delighted. They were delighted to sell off their handwritten scraps for freshly bound, beautiful books. He would do things like offer to build schools. He would give away cattle. So the idea of barter rather than direct cash for manuscript transaction was considered far more palatable to these people. And he just developed a real skill at knowing, how to reassure them, how to placate them, what to offer them, how much to value these books, the manuscripts. It was something that he did for 15 years, and obviously he got better and better at it. At first, he had very little luck, but, learned by experience.
And in this part of the world, cattle would have been a wonderful barter item. The book is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. Joshua Hammer wrote it. The book just came out, and the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Joshua Hammer has just published a wonderful book, a true story, called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. Let's talk about the threat that they faced in Timbuktu and why these manuscripts were threatened. This is a story that's become all too commonplace in our modern world, isn't it?
Yeah. The spread of radical Islam. Northern Africa was no exception. There had been trouble in the area really since the 1990s when Algeria, the country just to the north, had a really brutal civil war between Islamists and the military government. So you had this radical, basically a terrorist movement created in Algeria. It spread into Mali, which was a very sparsely especially in the north, which was sparsely populated and not really under any under any government control. So the radicals saw this area as a great place to build up their strength, establish training camps, kidnap the occasional tourist who came through and sold them for ransom. In 2000, gradually built up their numbers, recruited people in villages. At the same time, you had Saudi spreading extremist Wahhabi ideology across North Africa, building Wahhabi, the most extreme sect of Islam, building mosques, preaching to people. But what really created the crisis was the Arab Spring. In 2011, Muammar Gaddafi, the protests against Gaddafi, of course, they started in Tunisia, went to Egypt, spread to Libya. People rose up against the dictator Gaddafi. The U.S. backed this NATO plan to create a no-fly zone to bomb Gaddafi's facilities. Gaddafi fell. Chaos erupted across Libya. Government army slipped away. Arsenals owned by Gaddafi were pretty much left open. So the radicals pretty much helped themselves to an incredible array of heavy weaponry, drove back across the desert into Mali, and quickly destroyed military bases and sent the government army packing, and within a couple of months had basically controlled two-thirds of this country, and declared a caliphate in the north, and began implementing Sharia law. And, of course, Timbuktu and its manuscripts were right in the middle of this.
And it should be noted that Timbuktu had been the center of a very gentle religious tradition.
Yes. The whole northern part of Africa, most of the people there subscribe to Sufism, which is a branch of Sunni Islam that is considered moderate, somewhat mystical. Singing and dancing are permitted, worship of saints, lots of elements that the Wahhabis, the Saudi influenced Wahhabis, consider to be an anathema to the pure vision of Islam. They quoted hadith, sayings of the Prophet, saying emphasizing that any alteration, any adaptation from the Islam created by the Prophet in the 630s AD is not to be accepted and has to be stamped out violently if need be. And this ideology, of course, we see everywhere. This is the Islamic State's ideology. This is Al-Qaeda's ideology. This group of radicals affiliated themselves with Al-Qaeda in 2007. I forgot to mention that. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, called themselves Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Maghreb meaning north, Arabic origin word meaning northern Africa. So, yes, they considered Timbuktu's version of Islam to be unacceptable, and the manuscripts that came out of that tradition, although many of them were Qurans and Hadith, which they didn't have any objection to, there were a lot of secular works as well, works about celebrating music, poetry, romantic love, even sex. And all this stuff had to be erased from the culture in the views of these people.
My guest is Joshua Hammer. We're talking about his book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. You just mentioned some of these manuscripts and the variety of them. Let's talk about these books and what they look like and what makes them so special. I was intrigued to find out that they were using Italian paper in some of these. This is a great story.
Yeah, there was a big thriving paper trade. A lot of Italy, it originated, the paper trade in that part of the world originated in Fez. There were a lot of factories in Fez after paper making spread west from China. But I guess by the 15th, 16th centuries, Italy was the major producer of paper, linen paper, and it was shipped to Tripoli and other ports on northern Africa, on the Mediterranean, just across the sea. Made its way by camel caravan to Timbuktu, and became the foundations of this manuscript culture. There were scribes in Timbuktu, hundreds of these scribes who sometimes they copied famed books from other parts of the Middle East, like from Cairo by scholars in Iraq or Cairo or Damascus, great cities, even Spain when it was occupied by the Moors. So these works made it to Timbuktu and were copied and churned out by these scribes. And then a whole indigenous, local-based intellectual tradition began to flourish in Timbuktu. So a lot of original works came out as well. And these were beautifully reproduced in this kind of flowing Arabic calligraphy that was painstakingly done, but methodically done. They could turn them out fairly quickly, like 2 months a manuscript, you know. And then, of course, many of them were embroidered with beautiful designs. Gold leaf was often used, earth dyes. They added various elements like gelatin to make the colors sparkle more. And to this day, you know, you pick up some of these books and they just really glitter in front of you. It's like the great illuminated manuscripts of medieval Europe. Very similar, except of course that they don't have, because of Islamic prohibitions against reproducing the human figure, you don't see humans, you don't see people represented in the illustrations. You see amazing designs, geometric designs. You sometimes see depictions of landscapes or of mosques. You don't see people, but the artwork is just some of the work is just astonishing. Some of it reminds me of these incredible carpets that my house is covered with, carpets that I've picked up in Afghanistan and Pakistan and and Persia, you know, Iran. I mean, just beautiful, rich, embroidered, incredibly complex designs.
And your determined librarian and book hunter, Abdel Kader, was very fortunate early on to make a connection with a patron of sorts, Professor Gates from Harvard. And this is an important part of the story because we go back through the history of slavery, and one of the justifications that used to be used frequently was, oh, well, these Africans, they don't have the intelligence. They didn't even read books. They should be slaves instead.
That's right. The Enlightenment philosophers, Hegel, Kant, and Hume, among the most influential thinkers of that period in the West, all propagated this idea that Africans were illiterates with no history and had made no contributions to civilization. And again, as you point out, this was reinforced the idea that Africans were subhumans and gave justification to the slave trade. This whole period of intellectuality that flourished in Timbuktu was completely forgotten by the 18th, 19th centuries when these people were writing. So gradual rediscovery of them, as Gates points out in the book, when he was a kid in 1960, he read a Ripley's Believe It or Not cartoon that talked about Timbuktu as having these libraries in the 16th century, and he was astonished because he had grown up in North Carolina, even as an African American, with this idea that Africans were illiterates, savages living in the bush. So this, for a budding young scholar who would make his career as a supporter and popularizer of the idea of African culture and civilization, this was something incredible, extraordinary for him, and it stayed with him. And as he advanced in his career and became a Harvard professor, became obsessed with this notion of showing the world what the contributions of African society were. Timbuktu was the place that when he was in a position to get money to make a series of documentaries about African culture, Timbuktu was the first place he headed.
And we get some wonderful insights into Abdel Kader's personality. I love the account of the fact that Professor Gates was able to get him some funding to build a library, and he went ahead and built the library first and then informed them, well, we're going to need to build another one.
Yeah, well, Gates said you, as part of the conditions for this grant, he had to digitize and catalog all of his works, which were just, you know, really kept in piles. Abdul-Qadir had no idea what he even had. You know, nobody had ever taken the time to go through the manuscripts and catalog them. And, of course, digitization was a fairly new technology. But the Mellon Foundation, which gave all this money, said, you've got to do this first before we start building a library. You know, we need to know what's there, and we need to preserve these digitally. But for Abdul-Qadir, this was all kind of – all he wanted was to have the bricks and mortar. He wanted the building. You know, that's what gave him the cachet. I mean, he wanted to be the librarian, the custodian of this big building. That's what means something in that part of the world. So he ignored all of their requirements, took the money, built the library. It turned out that he built it in the floodplain of Timbuktu. It got washed away when the first rains hit, and he had to do the whole thing again with yet another – by begging Gates for another grant, which Gates, needless to say, was not too happy about, but managed to get acquire for him anyway.
My guest is Joshua Hammer. His book is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. Apparently, this book is getting some buzz. We're recording this interview right now, and I know you have another interview coming up with National Public Radio. That's a coup, huh?
Yes, I do. Second one this week, and all things considered.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Well, yes, I'm surprised. You know, I knew this is an inspiring story. You don't really read too much about victories over Al-Qaeda. They're more often these stories of horror and violence and death and hopelessness. So I guess people respond to this idea of a guy who is determined to beat them at their and really did it, you know, accomplish this right under their noses. But I did think that the remote location of the place, and most, as you point out, people maybe know the name Timbuktu, but couldn't even identify it on a map, much less Mali. So it's obviously a remote place with a lot of foreign names. But I think, you know, at Simon & Schuster, and there was a belief that the story itself might help this book reach a larger audience than you might normally have expected.
Well, this program is underwritten by 5 library systems in Southwest Ohio, and I'm sure that the many librarians who tune in to the Book Nook are enjoying the fact that we're featuring a book called The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu.
I think Simon & Schuster has been very clever and effective at making that case, at targeting librarians. And librarians do seem, as my editor said, to have embraced this book as their own. So that's very gratifying.
And as we're airing this, I'm sure some of our listeners are going to be saying, oh, I just heard him on All Things Considered this week, because this will run after you're on there. I assume they'll be taping that to run right away. We're going to continue our conversation with Joshua Hammer about The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. And up next in our next segment, we're going to talk about this invasion of Timbuktu and what that was all about and what it was like and what happened during this invasion and how these manuscripts were kept out of harm's way, most of them. And we're going to do that. But first, this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. The Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning during the 7 o'clock hour and every Sunday morning at 10:30. The book today is a real page-turner in many ways, but be careful with those pages because they're delicate. It is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts, and they were saving these manuscripts from these invaders. And your repertorial skills really come out in this section where you give us the biographies of these 3 primary leaders of these invaders. These guys are scary.
Yeah, thanks regarding the repertorial skills. I really wanted to give, you know, so often we have this, we read about these terrorist groups, and they're just kind of faceless organizations. You know, we hear occasionally about a Jihadi John or an Osama bin Laden, but it rarely gets beyond that. So I just felt for us to understand sort of what the antagonists, who the antagonists were, I needed to give these people a face. And there were three standout characters here. One was, who's still around making trouble, is a guy named Mokhtar Balmokhtar, an Algerian rebel, Afghani, who went to Afghanistan, became radicalized there, lost his eye, had a deep scar, just a classic terrorist, long scar running down his face, missing an eye, and became his first stage was as a cigarette smuggler in the Sahara. He made millions smuggling cigarettes from across Mali into North Africa. Became known as Mr. Marlboro. He was so successful. And then segued into running guns and kidnapping Westerners for ransom, smuggling drugs, and becoming one of the leaders of this group. His cohort, a guy named Abu Zaid, was a kind of a hunched, crippled terrorist who had suffered from rickets as a child and been humiliated by bullied. I mean, this is a classic case of a kid bullied by his peers, bullied by the police, who finds a power in radical Islam. And he joined forces with Mokhtar Balmokhtar. So you had these two Algerians. Then their counterpart, the third member of this triumvirate, if you will, was a very interesting figure who came. It was a Tuareg, a non-Arab group, the nomads of the Sahara Desert, fled the country, fell under the tutelage of Muammar Gaddafi, who served in Gaddafi's mercenary army, became an incredibly checkered career as a Tuareg rebel, mercenary, musician, songwriter, poet, rose to become a power in the Malian government, a close confidant of the president of the country. And then became radicalized, fell into Islam, started out as a pacifist, but slowly sort of went down the rabbit hole of radicalism and became a violent Islamist and joined forces with these two Algerians to create this very powerful rebel movement in the Sahara.
The book is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. I guess we should also mention that the musical culture of this region is particularly vibrant. I'm sure some of our listeners here on public radio are familiar with some of the artists who have come out of this area and become international stars. And there was actually a music festival that was taking place in this area before the invasion. And this is a nice footnote.
Totally. There was this incredible, as I pointed out in the book, this dovetailing of culture in and around Timbuktu in the early part of the 21st century, the first decade. You had these manuscripts being rediscovered, libraries opening, and at the same time you had this festival of celebration of Malian music, which was discovered by the West. And Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin was the first kind of big Western star to make his way there. That generated a huge amount of publicity. Then other Western stars started coming out. Damon Albarn, from Blur. Sorry, I'm not too up to my contemporary music knowledge. But and then of course Bono showed up in 2012. Jimmy Buffett played there in 2006 or 2007. Tom Freston from MTV, the founder of MTV and later Viacom, showed up and wrote a big piece about the festival for Vanity Fair. And so it really began, it turned into a phenomenon. I actually went there in 2008, and there were like 5,000 foreigners who showed up along with the 10,000 Malians. It was a huge event in the dunes about 30 miles outside of Timbuktu. So you had all this great activity going on. I mean, Timbuktu just seemed to be this flowering place open to the West. The music mesmerized people, the culture of the manuscripts mesmerized people. But in the background all this time, you had kind of the growing radical threat. So really it was just these two forces, one kind of democratic, multicultural, liberal, and then on the other, you have this radical Islam slowly gathering force in the desert just beyond, you know.
Let's talk about the invasion and occupation of Timbuktu. First, you had the Tuaregs who came in.
Yeah, it's really complex. The Tuaregs, as I said, this nomadic group in the desert, they kind of range between all across the Maghreb, but there's a large, you know, Algeria, there's a bunch, Niger, a large number in Mali, and for centuries, since the French invaded, they wanted to have their own homeland, and that idea never went away. They called it Azawad, because they really identified themselves as a distinct group with their own language, their own culture. They always felt discriminated against in these various societies, which they were. And so they agitated for a new nation called Azawad, which would be carved out of the desert. They were mostly secular. The vast majority of them were out of that Sufi Islamic tradition, very moderate, mystical. And then, at the same time that they were agitating, and they'd been rebelling against the Malian government, against the French, then the Malians for over a century. There have been four or five rebellions, all of them pretty brutally put down. And at the same time, you had these Islamists who wanted to create a caliphate, an extreme religious caliphate in the desert. So, because they both had, they had radically different ideas of the states they wanted to create, but there was a certain commonality of purpose. And so when those weapons suddenly became available, Gaddafi's arsenals became open, the Tuaregs and the radical Islamists kind of pooled their resources and made a pact to deal with the Tuaregs. Some Tuaregs said this is a deal with the devil. They recognized al-Qaeda as being people they really didn't want to do business with, but argued that without the support, the weapons, the manpower, they couldn't take control of the country. It's like, we'll deal with al-Qaeda now, and you know, we'll create our own state, and then we'll get Azawad. But in fact, so they did this. They had this pact alliance, unholy alliance, and they did succeed in a very short time of attacking all these army bases across the north, which were very held by very poorly trained, under-equipped soldiers, often without bullets, with rusty weapons, under-trained. A Malian politician told me the dregs of society. And these guys fled first opportunity, leaving open vast swaths of the north. In very short time, the Islamists and the Tuareg partners swept across the country, capturing Timbuktu on April 1st, 2012. And very quickly, as one could have predicted, the Tuareg secularists were swept away, pretty much, you know, driven out, and the Islamists, who were much more ruthless, radical, and smarter, seized control and began to really create a brutal Islamist state.
We are currently assessing the damage from the desecration and destruction of the Islamic State in ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. And this invasion of Timbuktu, these occupiers, they were more interested in abusing the population and doing other things. They didn't really focus on these ancient manuscripts initially, and they were more into doing things like desecrating graves. This was a big thing that they did, wasn't it?
Yeah, they knocked down a whole bunch of shrines because in Wahhabist thought, shrines to any, you know, these shrines were built to saints, to a lot of these people were dated back to the 16th century. They were philosophers and intellectuals, some of whom rebelled against the Moroccan invaders in 1593 and were executed. So they had this whole tradition of celebrating these martyrs, and they were sanctified in these sort of shrines where people went on a regular basis for good luck. You know, you have your patron saints in Christianity, Catholicism. Same idea, but the Wahhabis hated this idea because they saw it as anything other than pure reverence of Allah was a sacrilege, and these people deserve nothing less than death. I mean, but the first step was to just demolish these shrines. So they just would go in, seal them off, and then attack them with hammers and smash them into pieces. And so these weren't the most prepossessing buildings in the world, you know, just kind of mud huts, really, with some relics inside. But this was just, you can imagine the despair of the population when this happened. And you know, everybody feared, well, what's this? What is this augur for the manuscripts? You know, if they begin to destroy everything that we hold valuable here.
Joshua Hammer joins us. He has written The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and Their Race to Save the World's Most Precious Manuscripts. After the invasion, Abdelkader is lucky enough to get out of Timbuktu where he can coordinate the salvation of these manuscripts. And a key figure, a heroic figure in this rescue effort, is this young man, one of his relatives. This guy's really the hero.
Yeah, this guy's the unsung hero. He was 25, I believe, at the time, and he's the nephew of Abdelkader, and he stayed behind in Timbuktu to really do the hands-on evacuations. And while Abdelkader had taken refuge in Bamako, where he had sent his kids, and wanted to be with his kids, and just thought, you know, hey, I can be down in Bamako doing the fundraising. You know, I've got all my contacts. I can't do it from Timbuktu because the communication had gotten so bad up there. So he left Mohamed Touré in place. Mohamed Touré volunteered for this. And Mohamed Touré took the lead in doing all of the, when the time came that they felt that the manuscripts, which the first step was to move the manuscripts from the big libraries where they were easily spotted and targeted to, could be targeted, to people's private houses, discreet little storage rooms in people's houses scattered around the city. Then they began to get insecure about that and felt, well, maybe they'd be best getting out of Timbuktu and sending them to government territory across 550 miles of jihadist land. So Mohamed Touré really was the guy who put that all together. He organized the vehicles. He hired the drivers. He ferried him personally, himself escorted, made like 30 trips down this 660-mile route to Bamako to safety. And then the next phase, after the road route became too dangerous, they changed to river evacuation. So he took the lead in hiring the boatmen and carrying the boats down river. So this guy was just he was arrested a couple of times. At one point, he feared that he was going to be hauled before the Sharia court and sentenced to have his hand amputated. A couple of times he just had to talk his way out of trouble. He was a really resourceful guy, and yeah, the unsung hero of the story, because a lot has been written about Abdelkader, but almost nothing about this gentleman.
And it's such a cloak and dagger thing that they're going out and they're discreetly buying every trunk and everything that they could possibly find to conceal these manuscripts and do it without being noticed by the occupiers. What a wonderful thrill. This is a real thriller in a way.
At one point, they run out of trunks. They bought up every trunk in the region. So they resorted, as I point out in the book, to buying metal jerry cans of gasoline, normally used to hold gasoline, ship them down river or up river, which is actually south, to craftsmen in another town who were able to hammer these gas cans, I guess, join and weld them together and create more trunks. So that's how they kind of finally reached the number that they needed. I can't even remember how many it was, 10,000 or something, 10,000 trunks to take out 350,000 manuscripts.
And they rescued most of them. And
they did.
It's really an amazing story. Now, what's the current situation? Are those manuscripts still not in Timbuktu?
They're still not in Timbuktu. They are all in the capital of the city, which is Bamako, 660 miles south. And they've been moved to climate-controlled storage rooms, I think 10 of them in the city, large rooms with Western funding to prevent them from rotting further, because Bamako has a very humid climate, two rainy seasons, and just not good for these fragile books. And Abdelkader is still supervising all of this and waiting for the right moment to return them to Timbuktu.
Well, it's an absolute miracle that these manuscripts are still around with the climate conditions and the termites. That sounds like the biggest threat of anything.
Yeah, I mean, the scene I describe in the book where he finally negotiates and with a guy, and opens up the trunk that's been closed for 20 years, and there's nothing inside but a bunch of termites swarming around, eating the last shreds. And the guy breaks down in tears.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That is heartbreaking. Now that you've got the book out, but you're still following the story, obviously, are there any things that have transpired that you would have included in the book had you been able to? I noticed that you've got stuff in here that's fairly current.
Yeah, the last couple of attacks I was able to slip in there. I kept kind of redoing the epilogue frantically as, you know, but you don't want to get too sucked into these. It can kind of get jarring, adding the latest information. I mean, in a way, I kind of wished I'd kept it to 2014 and ended the story there. But of course, you can't really do that because these events are so important. Major terrorist attack on a hotel in Bamako, the infiltration of the Al-Qaeda down in the southern regions. You can't leave that out. So, there hasn't been anything really important to any development since that attack in Bamako, at least as far as Mali is concerned. Obviously, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, they're not capable of holding territory anymore as they once were because the French pretty much decimated them. But they can still, you know, these cells are there. They're hiding in the desert. They're infiltrating cities, and they can carry out these attacks and just keep things insecure for who knows how long.
Well, Joshua, I love a nonfiction book that reads like a novel, and this is one of those. I mean, it's just compelling, and you just can't read it fast enough. And I'm wondering, how did you get into being a journalist? What's your story?
Family heritage. Now, my dad was a journalist, actually, for the New York Times. So I grew up with this in New York City. And, I actually had dreams of being a playwright when I was in college. But I just got drawn in. I think it was a trip after college, 2 years traveling around as an English teacher in Japan and then backpacking my way around Asia that I just really kind of fell for the foreign correspondent bug and just followed that career. Still doing it, still hanging in there.
And the book just came out this week. I'm sure this is going to be a fun ride for you, going to be out doing some events and obviously doing a lot of interviews.
Yeah, you know, I hope more people feel the way you do. It's really great to hear your enthusiasm, and I don't think it's necessarily an easy sell because it is so far off the beaten track. On the other hand, maybe that fact alone is enough to get people interested. Just a story about the book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict a few years ago that did nothing, partly because that story is just so familiar. Mm. And I think there's such a level of fatigue with Middle East conflict. Also, it was a very sad, you know, downbeat tale. Here you've got an unfamiliar place with an upbeat ending. So maybe that combination will inspire people to read it because it was certainly fun telling the story.
Well, Josh, I have to guess that as librarians across the country are perusing their lists of books that they might be considering for their libraries, that every single one who sees that the Badass Librarians of Timbuktu just came out is going to place an order for it.
Let us hope so. It's looking good so far. That's a good audience to go for.
I think so. And librarians are wonderful at picking up a book and walking over to their patrons and saying, you've got to read this one.
Yeah. I've detected that a little bit already being here back in New York. It's really gratifying. People have come up to me at the couple of three book readings I've done and said that. Librarians have come to these readings. And yeah, I'm going to tell people about it. It's really exciting. So it's nice.
That is wonderful. Well, I see we're running out of time and you're getting ready to do that All Things Considered interview.
Yeah.
I just have one more question.
Uh-huh.
Is there another project on the horizon, another book maybe you're thinking
about?
I have
nothing yet in mind, but I'm back to kind of traveling the world doing my magazine, my long-form narrative journalism, and really, which I really love doing, but it's exhausting, and I would very much like to do another project. I kind of want to wait it to. I wanted to wait and see how the reaction to this, because of course that can often determine one's next project. So the viability of another project, you know. So, but I'll definitely get on something. I'd say, you know, I'm going to start an active search. I've got a couple of ideas percolating. You know, within 6 months, I hope to get something else going.
Well, I see you just won the National Magazine Award. What was the piece?
The piece was for an online publication that an editor friend of mine asked me to write for called Matter, And it was a story of a young doctor in Sierra Leone who was on the front lines of the Ebola crisis epidemic and saved a lot of lives and ended up dying of Ebola himself. So another unsung hero in a distant part of the world.
Well, Josh, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your book.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Really enjoyed it.
The book is The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu and their race to save the world's most precious manuscripts. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening.